Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1127. Let's talk about you, the ID10T community, events at ID10T.com for the thing that maybe you have made or someone you know has made and would like to promote, like Scott, who writes, "My name's Scott Greenberg. I'm a copywriter, podcaster, and music nerd originally from Detroit, now living in Charlotte, North Carolina. 2003, I started an eclectic music radio show as a way to help keep my sanity while in between jobs. This turned into a labor of love and something I can't imagine not doing. In February of 2020, I lost my job a week before my 10th anniversary as part of corporate restructuring. 3 months later, my station folded and I found myself without a radio home. Within days, a radio friend from back in Detroit presented me with the opportunity to turn the radio show into a podcast. It's now a year later, and I've got 50 episodes up. Great job, Scott. While I like to kid that debts no honest man can pay is a glorified eclectic music radio show masquerading as a podcast, it remains a labor of love, and I hope some of your listeners might take a moment to check it out. Find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for sharing, Scott. Everyone else, events at ID10T.com. And like Scott, you could appear at the beginning of a podcast promoting your thing that you have made. This episode is Asif Mandvi, who was on the podcast. I looked up, it was like 8 years ago. And, you know, Asif was on The Daily Show. He's a super funny guy, really great actor. And he is in one of our favorite shows that my wife and I discovered after he came on the podcast. We started watching his show. It's called Evil, and it is fantastic. It's, I guess, like a supernatural thriller, you would call it. But it's basically about a psychologist who is teamed up with a guy who's training to be a Catholic priest, who, by the way, is played by Mike Coulter, who you may know as Luke Cage. And then this guy who's just like a regular blue-collar contractor guy, and that's Asif's character, Ben. And they investigate this backlog of unexplained mysteries that the church has, including supposed miracles and demonic possessions and other extraordinary occurrences. And they sort of like, you know, is this a science thing? Is this a religion thing? And they kind of within the group try to sort of figure out each occurrence. But the show is fantastic. And Michael Emerson is in it, who, of course, was Ben Linus in Lost, and Christine Lottie, and Katja Herbers. And then one of the priests, a guy who's kind of like the main priest, is a guy named Peter Scolari, who was on Bosom Buddies with Tom Hanks and went on to be on the Newhart Show in the late 80s, early 90s. And he, just side note, is the guy that taught me how to juggle. When I was in college, I met him and we hit it off. And I used to go visit him on the set of the Newhart Show, and he taught me how to juggle. So I was so happy to see Peter on a show as well. I haven't talked to him in years, but Lydia and I absolutely love this show, and Asif is great on it. And it's on Paramount Plus. It was on CBS, and it went over to Paramount Plus, which is really cool because now they can swear on the show, taking full advantage of streaming services. It's season two is up now, and I believe. I'm going to double check, but I'm pretty sure it got picked up for season three. I hope it did because we're way into it. So that's Evil is the name of that show. Asif is on another show called This Way Up, and that is on Hulu. So it was just really fun to catch. The podcast has been such a great way for me to catch up with people that I haven't talked to in a long time. And this also in particular because Asif has tinnitus, which I also have, and I haven't really had like a conversation with anyone else who has it before. So we talk about that a bit in here as well. So here we go. This is the ID10T podcast number 1127 with Asif Mandvi returning to the podcast.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Oh my God, I don't think I've seen you in person in ages.
Yeah, I think that you and I, well, I did your podcast a few years ago.
Several years ago now. I mean, I think
several
it might
years ago. And then I saw you on the late night, and I was on the late night show with you, the game show.
Yeah, midnight program.
Yes, I did that. I was like a guest, not like a contestant, but like a guest on it. And then I ran into you, I think at the day, not at the, at the, not the Emmys, the other Emmys, the Creative Arts Emmys. I ran into you backstage at the Creative Arts Emmys. I think you might've been going to the green room and maybe I was going to the thing and we did the kind of like, Hey, what's up?
Hey, what's that? Well, yeah, those things are so, those things are sort of weird because it's, you see people that you want to talk to, but you also know that other people might be like trying to focus, especially if you're backstage.
Right.
And I always feel bad about saying more than two words to people if I don't know that they've already done their thing.
Right. Exactly.
I don't know what it's like for
probably
you.
Probably a good policy, actually. Cause I was backstage at the Tonys and I saw Tina Fey, and basically my wife and I, like, I think just like kind of got her in a, she was standing by herself, like watching the big screen, you know, that they have in the green room. And then like basically just talked to her endlessly for like 10 minutes and then realized like she was on, like 5 minutes later, she was on the screen, like presenting something. And I was like, oh, she was totally trying to prep, well, probably in her own, wanted to be left alone. And we just
But she's so amazing. I feel like you couldn't derail her. Like, you, I don't think you messed up whatever it is that she was like. No. I become kind of a, I just kind of outwardly shut down because I'm in my head just going over and over again the beats of what I think the thing is going to be, because I don't know like what the energy is going to be like when I go out on stage. So I just sort of like, I try to get it as much as I can, and then just, once you take that first step out on stage, it's like, well, gotta let it go.
I'm like that backstage. In the times that I've done stand-up and I'm backstage, I'm like one of those, like you're in the green room or whatever, and the other comics are like coming over and they're talking to you and they're, hey, what's up, man? Da, da, da. And I'm one of those people that I do stand-up infrequently enough to sort of get nervous every time I do it.
Of course.
But frequently enough to sort of feel like I know people in that world who like see me and they're like, hey man, oh, you're doing a gig tonight. And then I get very like antisocial because, and people probably think I'm like a dick because like I'm just like, oh, I'm really stressed because I haven't gone up on stage in like 6 months. And I'm like, So
no,
like, I know that's
upsetting you, by the way, for saying like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just going over my set. And we talk to you afterwards to be like, of course.
Yeah. And yet somehow I don't ever say that. I just kind of, I participate in the conversation and then I'm half in, half out. I'm sort of like, right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. Great.
Like, I feel like when you're doing that, you're dividing your brain. Like half of your brain is trying to just keep this ball in the air for this conversation as minimally as possible. And the other half of your brain is like, just that a list of everything you're supposed to do.
Right. And then the other part of your brain is going, I wish this person would shut the fuck up right now and just go away.
I love this person, but I wish they would leave me alone right now. I feel like most comics would understand if you said that. I don't know if this, I mean, there was something I did for a long time before I found out that it's actually a thing. But I would, if I was backstage and I was really nervous, I would start looking around and sort of calling out what everything in the room was to go, okay, like those curtains are blue, this floor is tile.
Oh, yeah.
And then I realized a few years later, like, oh yeah, that's mindfulness. Like that's just, that's being, I didn't really, entire philosophies and religions are based on this. And here I thought I was so clever, but it really, it's so easy to get trapped in this, the ether of your thoughts and how it's going to try to control the result and try to project it, that it just helped me, you know, just kind of
No, that's so funny that you say that, because I actually took an acting class years ago. And as you can tell, I basically learned this technique where the teacher in this class said, you know, if you are having that sense of like you're about to go on stage and you, you know, the anxiety or whatever, ground yourself in the scene, in what's real. Like this is the table and the floor and exactly kind of what you're talking about, which is like, you know, here's a lamppost, here's a thing, you know, whatever it is, just ground yourself in the reality of your surroundings and it'll bring you into the present moment and make you present. And you're right. Now that you say it, I realize, oh yeah, that is mindfulness. That's kind of, but I learned it like in an acting class as like a technique to just keep yourself from spinning out of control.
Yeah, just focus in the real world. Of course, the downside is if you do that before a stand-up set and you say all that stuff backstage and then you walk out, forget everything you're going to say and go, the curtains are blue, the floor is tile, good night. and not as helpful, not as helpful. Right.
It's a way to go. It's a way to go. I've sort of done that and then gone out and just stood there for like a minute without saying anything. And then people think it's a bit.
Yeah, that is a bold move because like that is a hard thing to do because every molecule in my body would want to be like, fill the time. What are you doing? Fill the time.
Yeah.
To be able to do that, did you find that it kind of got people to like focus? Like what's he going to do? Like they really got.
I did it once and I realized that I went out there and just like smiled at people and just looked at them and sometimes gave them like a little like look, you know, like a hey, you know. So it wasn't entirely not filled, but it wasn't right. Filled with like a lot of, you know, it was filled with kind of like, and people, what was interesting was it grounded me, but it also grounded them. In the sense they were like, what's he did? Like, he's not saying anything. He's just looking at us and just sort of like, I just kind of go like, you know, like, you know, like that kind of thing. And just sort of pick out people and just sort of ground myself in different faces of people. And you could see that people was like, what's he doing? What's he going to do? Like, you know, it brings them in a little bit. So
What was your opening joke like? Was it about them, the situation? Was it something personal? Like what?
I just launched into a story, but it was very like, it was just like, it was just kind of like, so I was walking down here, you know, I mean, it just sort of like started with like a story.
That's a really great idea. That literally would never occur to me to do that because I feel like the second I get in front of the microphone, it's like, hey, we're on. Here we are. Hey, how's it going?
Yeah.
I just get really, you know.
It's definitely, and I haven't done it a lot, but I found that it helped me. Like, it just really helped me. Like, I when I went out there, rather than just like, because otherwise I would find like, I just go, and then the first like minute or so was me just like I was swimming, but I didn't know how to swim, you know, and then you find your groove and you're in it. But I remember it was actually an acting teacher that told me that. He was like, just try and go and just be still for like, the first and see what happens. Just try it out.
That's fantastic. Because ultimately I think an audience, when they come together for a show, for a stand-up show, of course they want you to be funny, but I think they also need to feel comfortable that you know how to lead the room, you know, yeah. Like to a degree they're seeding the momentum of the night in that hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it is. And whatever it is that you do, even if they're not, even if it's not something that's designed to make them fold over in half with laughter, as long as they feel like, you know what, this guy's got this. I can trust that he knows what he's doing. It's like a pilot, basically. You know, you wouldn't want a pilot.
No, that is one thing. Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I've realized that, like, it took me a while to learn that. And I don't do stand up all the time, but the one thing I have realized about it is that as long as the audience knows that you're in control and you know where we're going, mm-hmm. they're okay.
Right.
And they won't hate you. The minute they realize they're in control and you're out of control,
yeah,
that's when they resent you. And mm-hmm. then it's like just fucking contempt. Then it's just like, fuck you.
Yeah.
For bringing us here.
It's like, the parents realizes you don't know what you're doing. And they're like, get the fuck off. I thought you were cool. You're not cool. This is, right. We're done.
Exactly. And that's the thing is that it's almost a fallacy. More than anything, it's that projection of like, and you can be crazy and, you know, neurotic like Woody Allen or something, you know, in that. But as long as the audience feels like you have what you said, well, you've got your hands on the steering wheel, you know, right. and sometimes I've seen, and that's true probably even in any kind of, not just stand up, but like, even if you're like giving a speech somewhere or you're just like presenting or, you know what I mean? Like you're just doing whatever, like if you know what you're doing and you feel, even if you're doing a shitty job, as long as you know, as long as the audience thinks, oh, he knows what he's doing. He's shitty, but they might not like your jokes or your stuff, but they will respect you to the degree that you are up there doing it, as opposed to like when you lose control and then they just go like, fuck you. We're going to kill you now.
You have to be okay though. And it's difficult to fake that but you really have to feel like, you know what, no matter what happens up here, it'll be fine. And as long as, and it's some of that comes with experience, and some people just naturally have that. And then there are people who are sociopaths who never don't know any other way. But as long as you kind of feel that way, even if a joke doesn't kill, I feel like you can roll past it pretty quickly and it won't register with them, you know, unless you really point it out. You know, again, like if you're a pilot and you hit some turbulence or something, you're like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. Did you? Oh, man, that didn't go well. You know, then everyone on the plane's going to be like, fuck, I don't feel safe now. Why is he not? You know, but if it's just like, oh, yeah, you know, like, yeah, we hit a pocket, it's fine. We'll be fine. You go, okay, it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And I think, I mean, it's one of those lessons that I continue learning, which is, and continue trying to learn, which is that idea of it's okay to fail, you know, like if you go up there and you're like embracing failure on some level, like, yeah okay, that then your expectations for yourself are set and you actually don't get rattled as much by it. But again, that's a whole other level of mindfulness.
I want to if it's okay, I'd love to add to that and say that if you're even thinking about it in terms of failure, you might be too result oriented, you know. I think you have to be okay with whatever. Obviously failure is sort of I think we would define failure as just bombing horribly, doing a bad job. But even if your set isn't great, it doesn't necessarily have to be a failure unless you take it there, you know what I mean?
It's true.
Have to be catastrophic.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one time I did stand up and I was doing it was down in the East Village. And I remember going out there and I was like, I'm going to read. Cause it was like a you know, try new stuff out kind of place night. And I just was like, I wrote this story and I'm going to read it. Cause I didn't have it memorized. And I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to read it. And I started reading the story and I realized halfway through, like, it's just not that funny. And I could see the audience just being like, ugh. And I was literally, it was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible feeling. And I look out in the audience and I see Peter Dinklage and he's sitting there. And I know Peter, and I've, you know, known him for a number of years in New York and stuff. But I remember looking at his face, and I'll never forget it, because it's just like the whole universe just stopped. He was sitting next to two women, and he was sitting like on this sort of like, you know, at a booth or something. And he was sort of, and he had this look on his face that was basically like this.
Like he's trying to work out what you were doing.
Like he was just like going, why is Asif doing this? Like it was like,
I think it's fine. No, I think that's fine though, right? I mean, yeah, he's.
No, I mean, I was. It is fine, right? And yet I was devastated. And I just came off stage, and some of my friends were in the audience who had been there, and they had like bought drinks and stuff, and they were like hanging out by the bar. And I came off, and I was like, "We got to get out of here. We got to get out of here. We got to go." And I was, and they were like, "We just bought drinks. Like, hang out. Let's hang out. Like, it was great." And I was like, "No, I have to. I gotta go. I gotta go. I gotta go." And I literally like walked out of the club. And they were like, "We just bought drinks." Like, what? And I was like, "I'll be at the restaurant down the street on the corner. Come meet me there when you're done." And my friends were just like, "Okay." And so they drank half their drinks and then just like met me at this place. They were like, "What the fuck?" And I was like, "I couldn't be in that room. I could not." And I didn't want to look at Peter Dinklage in the eye. I could not even.
Did you ever run into him again?
Huh?
Did you ever run into him again?
Yeah. I actually did. Like years later, I saw him at something and I was like, "Dude, do you remember that night when I got?" And to me, and this is the other thing, right? To me, it was such a huge experience of just, I was so humiliated and Peter didn't even remember it. Like but he remembered me doing stand-up. He was like, "Oh yeah. And I was like, "You were there." And "I looked out at you and you had this look on your face. Like, what the fuck is happening right now? Like, why is this happening?" And you looked like I had just decided to do a striptease or something. Like, you were just like, why would he do that? And he was just like, "Really?" He was like, "Oh, yeah, I guess." Yeah. And he was just kind of like, totally like, that was not what was. And so it's so funny also, like how you just, you know, project what it is that what I thought in that moment of myself, I projected onto Peter, and he was probably just like had some vacant expression on his face that, you know, and later he had no recollection of at all. So
you don't even know. It's like you'll map all this stuff onto it based on whatever kind of insecurities you're feeling. He might have been thinking about an audition that he, like, you don't even know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Did that close the loop? Were you in your brain though? Did that kind of like
in a weird way it did. It sort of made me go like, "Oh," and I've had that happen a couple of times. Like I had one, I feel like I'm dropping names now, but whatever. Like when I was at the Daily Show, Justin Timberlake was a guest and I went backstage just to say hi. Cause whatever, like, you know, it was like Olivia Munn was on the show at the time and she was like, "Come say hi to Justin." And I was like, "Okay." So I went back and I said hi to Justin, and my niece, you know, was about 10 years old or something at the time. And I was like, "Listen, I never do this. I never, this is like such a stupid thing." I was like, "But could I get a picture with you? Because my niece is a big fan of yours." And, you know, and he was like, "Oh yeah, sure." And he was totally cool about it. And we took a selfie and he was like, "You know, how old is your niece? And I said, "She's, you know, 10. And then he said, "Oh, well, she's probably a little young for my music, isn't she?" And I said, "Yeah, but she's just going to think you're Zac Efron anyway."
I mean, he had to think that was funny. Did he laugh?
He did laugh. And then I walked out of the room and Olivia was like, "What the fuck did you say that for?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" And she was like, "Why would you say that to him? Like, why would you insult him like that?" And I was like, "Oh my God, I didn't even, I just was making it. It was just a joke. It was like, it was like a kind of, and it was like kind of one of those jokes where he sort of like, he didn't even laugh. He just kind of went, "Oh," you know, like sort of like a half thing. Like, and I was just like, "Oh my God." And I felt so humiliated and thought about that moment. Like, "Oh my God, I totally like was such an asshole to Justin Timberlake, who I have no reason to be an asshole to, because totally like there's no reason." And then years later, I run into him. I go into the Bowery Hotel in New York and I'm with my wife and some friends. And Justin is sitting there with some friends of his and he sees me and he goes, "Hey, Asif." And he remembered me. And I was like, "Oh." So I went over there. My wife was going like, "How do you know Justin Timberlake?" Like, she's confused by the whole thing. And I go over there and he's like, "Hey man, how are you?" Blah, blah, blah. And we're just making small talk. And then I said to him, I said, "I'm really sorry about that time when we were at the Daily Show and I made that really made fun of you, and I called you Zac Efron, and he was literally like, "What?" And I was like, "That time when I," and then he was, I could see like he was just like, "Oh, oh, okay," and I was like, "You know what? Just forget it. Forget the whole thing."
I really feel like the way to have closed that loop is when he called you over. Go, Zac Efron, how are you, buddy? Like,
I know.
I feel like that's how
I should have done it. But clearly, again, he had no memory of it. It didn't land on him at all. It was just on me. Like, I was the one who was like perseverating over it for 6 years.
That's great. I love that you bring that up, because I do think that is a thing a lot of people do. A lot of there's a lot of ruminating, a lot of replaying. And I, even though we're sort of having this casual conversation about these embarrassing things that we do, and I've done that a million times too, it's like, how do we, and I know a lot of people do, overthink, how do you finally let yourself out of it? Like, does it just kind of dissipate after a couple of days, or do you have any kind of a thing that you do to like, okay, I'm going to allow myself, because I guess if we're talking about mindfulness, mindfulness would probably dictate that you would say, you would see yourself as the observer of that thought. I see that my thoughts are feeling bad about a silly thing that I did, and just kind of observe it. Do you let it go? Like, what's your process?
I think that the ultimate realization is that nobody's thinking about shit that you did.
Except you.
As much as you are. You know, like I have these moments in my life where I've just made an ass of myself, and I realize like I just told you two of them. I could tell you more, but the thing is, in those moments, I'm going, oh fuck, you know that. But you realize that like people are obsessed with their own lives, like the way you are, like they're thinking about their own shit. Like the thing that you said to them like 5 years ago. In a corridor somewhere, like, you know, like while you, whatever, it doesn't. Yeah. And I just realized that like, oh yeah. Like most of the time people are just like, yeah, whatever. And then also just the fact that you just own it, you know, you just go like, I'm an ass. You know, I say sometimes I put my foot in my mouth, you know, like that kind of thing. It's just like,
well,
it's just one of those things.
Yeah. But it's also like, if you work in comedy, if you're, you know, like, sometimes it's just sort of a knee-jerk reaction to try to break the tension of a, you know, of a situation. Yeah. Just like fuck around. And other times I feel like we're unconsciously testing to see if other people have kind of like a comedy thing, you know, because when you meet those people and you make a silly joke, if they kind of one up it or go along with it, then it's like, oh, hey. And then all of a sudden you've really connected with someone. And if they don't, you might go, oh, okay, well, that's not the, you know, either they're not in the mood or maybe they're just not that way. And
yeah,
you can just have a more cordial, like,
yeah, you know, acquaintance. No, and I think that's true. And I think, look, it's happened to me the other way as well. Like people have said stuff to me and I've just, you know, to me, it just like went away, like rolled off my back or whatever. It was just a moment. It happened. You know, that person was a little bit stupid. That was a stupid thing to say or whatever, you know what I mean? But then that's it, you move on. And when they have come to me and said something about it or whatever, I've had moments in my life where I've been like, wait, what? What are you talking about? And then you kind of go like, oh yeah. Okay, yeah, no worries. You know, and I know what it feels like, because you don't want to dismiss the fact that they're having these feelings about it, but then you're also just like, it didn't register. Like, I don't remember, like, it didn't make a big impact on me. So,
yeah,
you know, and so you realize that, like, yeah, we're all just kind of human.
I try to super let people off the hook if they're like, oh, this one time and I have no idea, or even if I do remember, but it just wasn't a big deal. I really try to say, like, I understand what you're feeling. I have felt this way before, but I am telling you, do not worry yourself about it even one second more. That's-
Wow.
Not a big deal. And you're fine. We're fine. All good.
Oh,
you know,
that's like, nice. That's nice of you that you engage. That's good. That's probably a good way to, like, you know, just not dismiss the feelings, or whatever, you know, and
yeah, because you don't want them to go away going, oh, I shouldn't have brought it up. And the next time, God, remember when I brought up the thing about the other thing? Yeah. God, I feel really.
You just feel doubly. Yeah. You just like, now, like, I'm like, I even feel more stupid now for bringing up the thing.
It's basically like when you're losing money at a blackjack table and you start doubling your bets to try to. And then all of a sudden you've lost an order of magnitude more than what you, because you just.
You've lost your house. So you're just
you just keep doubling down.
Yeah, you just keep going down. Yeah.
I want to ask you about something that I read about you online and because it's something that I experienced too. Do you have tinnitus or tinnitus?
I do.
I do too. And I haven't talked to a lot of other people who have it.
Yeah.
And I would love to just talk for a few minutes about it because I have this feeling that it's, you know, they say like 10 to 15% of people have it, but I feel like that number's probably got to go up because we're in the generation that grew up with fucking headphones and Walkmans and now AirPods and earbuds. And I feel like the occurrence of it is going to increase significantly. So I'm curious, when did you discover, was it a certain event or is it just something that you...
No, so what happened to me was... I had a so mine was a little bit uncharacteristically like the way that people normally get it, where I got it.
You don't want to talk about it. I don't know what it is. I just don't.
No, it's fine. I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
I got it because I had a situation in my ear canal, and I still do, which is it's a chronic condition. It's a skin condition that is in my ear canal, which causes my ear canal to want to close down. Basically. Mm-hmm. And now after years of seeing doctors and stuff, I have, you know, treatment for it and I have ongoing doctors who take care of it. But when I first discovered this situation, it was a doctor in New York. She, I won't name her, but she discovered this thing and she did something that she shouldn't have done, and I allowed her to do it, which was she went in and she just did some minor surgery in my ear canal with some topical, what do you call it?
Anesthetic?
Anesthetic. And that caused scar tissue in my ear canal and on my eardrum. And I literally woke up the next day and there was like a bang in my ear. And I didn't know what it was. And I remember I had gone, and it was weird because I probably didn't hear it because my apartment in New York was pretty noisy and whatever. I didn't hear it as much. But I went out to the Hamptons for the weekend with a friend and I was in this very quiet house and I woke up in the middle of the, I went into this room and it was like 8 o'clock at night. Everyone was going to bed. I'm not 8 o'clock, it was like midnight, whatever. Everyone was going to bed. And suddenly I'm in this place where there's no sound and I just hear this and I thought it was like the cables or something outside, like the power lines or something. And it was really scary and I called my doctor and she said, oh, it'll go away. Don't worry about it. It's probably just something that happened. And then I, you know, subsequently it didn't go away and it stayed. And I went back to see her and she was like, oh, the scar tissue and da da da. And it was just a whole thing. And so, yeah, consequently, it's remained with me ever since then. That was 10 years ago. And I still have it. But the amazing, I don't know about your tinnitus and how it sort of manifests for you, but I did a lot of reading about it at the time and tinnitus is a condition that actually is in the brain. It's not in the ear because your ear is just simply a vessel through which sound travels to the brain and it just puts the sound in order. So it's something like having feedback on a speaker, you know? And the amazing thing about tinnitus also is that initially, your brain hears that sound as a threat, and it freaks, and it goes, what the fuck is this? Like, this is not supposed to be here. But over time, depending on, I mean, different people have different experiences. For me, I will just say that, like, over time, I have adjusted to the sound. Mm-hmm. And also it was my hearing diminished as a result of what happened. And then I started wearing a hearing aid in that, and then that helped with the tinnitus a little bit. But because it's also like a kind of, it's connected to hearing loss, and a lot of people who have it from like loud noises or whatever, it's because you have hearing loss at a certain pitch and the brain is trying to fill in the frequency.
Oh my God.
And so like, what is yours like? What do you hear?
Mine was, I went to a concert at the Hollywood Bowl a handful of years ago, and I went with some friends and we had kick-ass seats. We were like right behind the orchestra pit, and I don't go to concerts very often.
Right.
And I just never occurred to me, like, bring earplugs. And at the beginning of the concert, they all pulled out, like, these... One guy had molded to his ear earplugs. And I was like, what the fuck? Oh, no. And I kind of had this realization of, like, that's something I should have done.
Yeah.
And after the first couple songs, someone gave me an extra set of them, and I put them in. But it was sort of too late at that point. It's very loud. It was a great concert, but it was really loud. And then they rang for a while, and then I went to an event about a month later, and we were outdoors, and there was a DJ, and it was loud, and I started to kind of feel like, oh, this might not be good for my ears. And we left, and we were in the car, and it was just like, so for me, I hear it in both ears. And it's an incredibly shrill, high-pitched tone. And the thing about it that I think some people don't really realize is, like you said, it's in your brain. But it also has this weird emotional component, because if you find yourself, or at least if I find myself anxious, it goes up. But what's insidious about it is that it will sometimes create that anxiety. And so it creates this, like, I don't know, lack of a better word, feedback loop. And then you're like, oh my, I mean, when I first discovered it, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to live my life hearing this all the, I mean, it's like, and I realized I read and like, oh, everyone feels that way when they first, did I always have this and I just didn't notice it? But I do find, like you said, over time, your brain, it becomes a lot less stressful. And now, if I hear it when it's quiet at night, it's like, oh yeah, that. And maybe I'll turn on a little white noise machine or something, or a little on.
Yeah.
But there's a.
I find mine goes up. Like you said, stress. If I'm tired, if I'm overly tired, sometimes when I eat a lot of sugar and stuff like that. So in a weird way, it's been a good sort of thing for my diet.
They say, and I don't know if there's actual science to back this up. I don't know, but they say things like sugar and caffeine, anything that elevates your heart rate.
Yeah.
Increases the.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
And then that makes it, there's a company that's just come out with a device, and I don't know anything about it. I can't tell people to go do it. I just find it interesting and I might try it, but it's a wristband that has like haptic feedback on it. And for 10 minutes a day for like 2 months, it plays a series of tones, and I guess, and it vibrates on your wrist. And I guess the theory behind it is that it trains your brain you're trying to train your brain to recognize what sounds are exterior to your ears and what sounds are interior to your ears.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
So that your brain will go, oh, I don't need to hear this because it's not a real thing in the external world. I don't know if it works, but I think it's called neosensory, but I might try it just to see, you know, like.
Yeah, I'd be interested. Yeah. I mean, for me right now, it doesn't, in my day-to-day life, it doesn't affect me, but I do hear it. Like you said, like late at night, if I'm tired, if I'm stressed, if I've eaten a lot of salt or sugar, stuff like that, or like I'm just not, you know, like those things, any kind of thing where I'm feeling anxious or whatever, like it will start to be louder. And there are just some times where I'm just like, you know, and if I go to loud places, it's the same thing. Like if I go to a loud club, which I don't really do that much anymore. And luckily, you know, this happened to me as a middle-aged guy and I wasn't like raving and partying, like, you know, I'm 21. But if I do go to a loud concert or even a Broadway musical or whatever, like I'll notice that it's like, I'll come home, I'll hear it, it'll be louder. And then for me, it's like, I just got to go to bed.
Right.
I'm like, sometimes I'll just tell my wife, I'm like, it's really loud right now. I got to go to sleep. And then if I go to sleep by the morning, it will be at another, it'll pitch down a little bit, you know, come, but it's, yeah, it's been an interesting journey. And I have to say, like, I thought the same thing when it first happened. I was like, this is, I don't know how I'm going to have a career. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to live. Like, I remember telling my manager, like, listen, I've got this thing and I don't know what's going to happen, but it may affect like my ability to work and, you know, and get jobs. And look, thank God, you know, it's about the resilience of the way our brain works and how, you know, stuff that we deal with in life. And so, yeah. And I know it's amazing also how many people have it and live with it, you know?
Yeah. And I guess I thought it would be interesting to talk about just because I haven't talked to a lot of the people who have it, but also for anyone who's just discovering or for anyone who has it, who has that initial like panic response, like it will get better. Like it gets okay. Your body does adjust to it. But if you don't know what it is, most people will be like, well, that doesn't sound. And it's like, well, if you, if there was, you know, if there was like a car alarm going off all the time,
right.
You know, at a certain point, you'd be like, okay, what the fuck, you know? So yeah. I guess part of this was also just to let people know that, because I do think it's going to become more of a problem because we're an earbud culture now.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. I think that, you know, I mean, people listen to music incredibly loud on their earbuds and there's just a lot of, you know, our ears are actually not, you know, especially if you live in a city like New York or, you know, or a big urban center, like our ears are not really meant to deal with this much constant noise. You know, like
ask for the Industrial Revolution.
Right. You know, it's like we're just meant to live in like the woods and like
hear a
deer or something. You know what I mean? Like it's like, So yeah, I think the more and more it's kind of all, I think you're going to see people maybe struggling with it. And hopefully that will also inspire, because unlike people who have things with their eyes, I feel like things that are connected to the ears, there's not as much research and money being spent on stuff for the ears.
Because, well, yeah, for that in particular, I don't think it wouldn't really be considered life-threatening, but it's definitely quality of life-threatening if you don't know how to deal with it and de-stressing, trying to keep your anxiety levels down. Because, you know, like a lot of the recommendations are like, you know, like anti-anxiety medication. It's like, well, I don't want to be on that. Like, I don't want to have to rely on.
No, I took Klonopin for a while, like right after, is it Klonopin?
That is an anti-anxiety. I think it's benzodiazepine maybe. I don't know.
So I took Klonopin for about a month or so when it first happened to me, just cause I would be shaking at night in bed. Like I couldn't get to sleep. Like I would just like lie. Like I remember I was traveling and stuff and I'd be like in a hotel room and I'd just be like, have these shakes because I was like, hearing this noise, it was just terrifying. And I took Klonopin and it helped me a little bit, but then ultimately the thing that helped the most, I mean, this is just the reality of it, is that like over time, it just starts to integrate into your life and it just starts to become a thing, you know, like, okay, I have this, I have tennis elbow. Like I have this. You know what I mean? Like,
you know, and when you're distracted, you don't really notice it. Yeah. So I'm glad you said that, because I just, again, it's, I just want people to know, like, if you have it or you've just discovered it, you know, it's manageable and it won't all be that. And even occasionally, if it spikes a little bit, it won't, it'll go back down, you know, like you'll be, because even that, even hearing that, like videos I watch where people said that, I would almost feel it quiet down a little bit in those moments.
Yeah. Because
I'd go, oh, okay. All right. You know what? I'll just, it, you know.
Well, it's also one of those things where the more you talk about tinnitus, the more you hear it.
Right.
Because your brain goes, oh, right, that's it. You know what I mean? It's like one of those weird things.
Well, then let's stop talking about it and talk about some other things. First of all, you do so many cool things. Not just, you know, with acting and writing and, but also you did the Smithsonian podcast, The Loss of the Smithsonian, and there's really cool stuff in there. You guys are finding like Fonzie's jacket, and all these really cool, like Dorothy's Oz, the ruby slippers, and all these really cool cultural artifacts that, now, as we are, in pre-1900s, you know, you would think of historical items as being like a Gutenberg press or like the quill that, you know, they used to sign this document. But now it's like, oh yeah, well yeah, Fonzie's jacket. These things are like they're artistic cultural touchstones.
Yeah,
and should be preserved.
Yeah,
and so there are these things at Smithsonian, just locked in archives.
Yeah, no, they actually let me run wild in the behind the scenes in the archives, and they have these huge storage facilities that are temperature controlled, and you know, you walk in there and it's kind of insane. It's like oh, here's Babe Ruth's jersey, and he, you know, and I was focusing the series I did on Lost of the Smithsonian, which was focused on American entertainment. And so they were all artifacts from American entertainment. And I got to talk to amazing people. You know, I got to interview Henry Winkler.
Nicest guy.
Which was a dream come true for me, because I was that nerdy kid that had a picture of Fonzie on my wall when I was a kid. You know, like I had like, so he was like, you know, me and my friends would walk around school, be like, hey, you know, doing the whole Fonzie thing. And then to interview the man himself and just, you know, talk to him and stuff, it was really kind of cool. And then we did an episode on Archie Bunker and Edith's chairs from All in the Family. And I got to interview Norman Lear. And we did episodes on so the weird thing was, one of the episodes came about because we were going through we did the Muppets, you know, and that was kind of really cool. And I got to interview Frank Oz for the Muppets. But we were, one of the curators was taking me through the archives, and they'd open up these doors of these metal closets, and they'd just be like, you know, and these are Leonard Nimoy's ears from the, you know, the last Star Trek movie or whatever, you know what I mean? It was just like this crazy shit everywhere, you know? And at one point he pulls out this laptop, and he goes, this is Sarah Jessica Parker's laptop from Sex and the City. And it so happened that I was on Sex and the City.
Right.
And I was the guy that fixed her laptop.
was that the actual one?
So that was... I'm sure there's more than one, but it was one of them, you know what I mean? And so he was like, oh, this is the laptop that she, I forget her character's name.
Carrie Bradshaw,
right. So he was like, so this is Carrie Bradshaw's laptop from Sex and the City. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I know. I fixed this laptop. My character fixed this laptop on the episode called My Motherboard Myself, which was nominated for an Emmy and whatever. And so then we were like, why don't we just do an episode about this?
That's really fun.
And so we use these artifacts as a conversation into larger themes. So the Carrie Bradshaw computer became a conversation with the creator of Sex and the City, the woman who wrote the original book, and it became about, you know, women in the 90s and sort of the culture of television, right? You know, telling stories about women for the first time in that way that felt like we'd never seen before. And
what a
and
really so great
we idea. Had some of these great conversations, like the conversation with Henry Winkler about Fonz's jacket turned into a conversation about acting and how he created that character as a nerdy Jewish kid who like was like, you know, sort of just this nebbishy guy created this like almost Jekyll and Hyde character. Like that was his Mr. Hyde, you know, that was like, it was like this character came out of him that was not him and how he sort of did that. And also, you know, we ended up talking about the sort of inherent weird misogyny that existed in that time and that, you know, like Fonzie clicking his fingers and girls running over to him. And, you know, like, what would that be today? Like, how could you talk about, could you tell that story today? And could you, you know, and he talked about his thoughts on that, which were really interesting. And then I also interviewed Jose Feliciano, which was a fantastic thing because we were walking around the Smithsonian and we, and the guy, the curator opens up this thing and there's Jose Feliciano's guitar that he sang the national anthem with at the 1968 World Series. And he got booed because they didn't like the way he sang it. Cause he did this really folksy, it's actually, it's on YouTube. You can watch it. It's a really cool folksy kind of artistic version of, oh, say, can you see, you know, the Star Spangled Banner. People booed him and they were like, get this hippie, like, Hispanic hippie guy out of here. And it was really interesting because he was actually staying down the street. And so they brought him to the Smithsonian. They said, he's, you know, he's in town. So I was like, can I interview him? So they bring him over. He comes with his wife. We sit down, and we're talking. It's one of the best episodes of it because we're talking. And I said to him, you know, what happened to you is sort of like what's happening to the Colin Kaepernicks, because you were doing something which was an expression of what you thought was true, and you know, and he was like, oh no, it's totally different. It's totally different. And he did not go for it. And I was really shocked because I thought he was gonna like identify himself with these football players who are taking the knee and all that. And he had a whole like different opinion of it. And I thought that was really fascinating to listen to it. And then he wrote a song right there about his guitar. And
he just guitar? Started, did he play the guitar?
Huh?
Did he actually play the guitar?
Yeah, he started playing the guitar because he had the guitar right there. And then he just started playing it and started singing. And the next thing you know, he's singing the song. And it's this beautiful, like, you know, acoustic guitar song. And he gets done and then he goes, I'm probably going to have to, you know, publish that or something so you could use it in the thing. And I was like, wait, what do you mean? That's not a song? And he's like, no, I just wrote that.
Oh my God. And all of that is on the podcast.
It's all in there. Yeah, you can listen to it. It's really kind of genius.
That's such a phenomenal idea because, you know, on the surface level, it's already just interesting to sort of talk about the history of these different pop culture things, props, things that are, you know, the fabric of pop culture. But then for you to take that and then expand it and use it as a way in to these broader conversations, it's such a brilliant idea. It's just such a great idea. And I know that Lost in the Smithsonian is available still because I saw it. So can listen.
It's available. Yeah, you can download it and check it out.
All the different things that you do, is there anything in particular that you feel like resonates with you the most, whether it's hosting or comedy or writing or theater acting or film acting or television acting? How do you, like, what is the thing for you that if someone were to meet you and they go, hey, well, you know, I'm Chris, I'm a banker, and you go, oh, I'm Asif, I do X. Like, what would you say?
I mean, at the end of the day, I guess I am where I started, which is I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an actor. I'm an art. I mean, I guess I'm an artist. That sounds very kind of like hoity-toity, pompous, you know. But it is. I like to tell stories, you know. I like to create, and I've had the opportunity to do that in different formats: writing a book, doing the podcast, doing, you know, being an actor and telling other people's stories on TV or in movies or whatever. But and I've done comedy and I've done drama, and I've gotten the opportunity to toggle back and forth and do, you know, do both of those things. I've never thought of myself, I think because The Daily Show was such a phenomenal zeitgeist sort of show, people often think of me as a comedian. And, but that's not how I've ever identified myself. I feel like I've always thought of myself as an actor who does comedy. Mm-hmm. And who does dramatic stuff. And like what I'm doing now on Evil is a completely, you know, a different type of thing than The Daily Show. It's drama, you know. And I've done both in my career. So I guess, you know, my first love, or the thing where I started, was acting in theater. You know, that's what I really, where I started and what I sort of identify with is the purest form of whatever it is that I do, you know, for me.
But it is also interesting now that, because I think when you and I were growing up, things were very, you know, like hosts were hosts, actors were actors, stage. There wasn't a ton of crossover, and it just feels so nice now to be able to do so many different types of things. Are you?
Oh yeah.
Are you?
Not, back then, it was like if you did TV, you weren't going to do movies. You know, like if a TV actor wasn't going to be in a movie or a movie star, you know, and now I think the world is just so different with the internet, and you know what I mean? Like we live in a different world now. Like now you can host a show, you can host a game show, and you know, Jamie Foxx is hosting a game show.
Right.
As an Oscar.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can do that. It's not, there's no sort of rules anymore in that way. Like you just, you know, and that's great. I feel like for someone like me, who has just always thrived on doing a lot of different things, I love that. You know, I think it's great.
Is because I know Evil's back now. I think it came back June 20th.
Yeah.
That's on CBS, and then
it's actually on Paramount Plus.
Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
I get confused because everything Paramount Plus was CBS All Access, right. And became Paramount Plus and incorporated all this Viacom stuff, and so it's even that I'm still, it's when we were growing up, everything was pretty much just the way it was for decades, and now we're in the midst of this whole transformation of what content means, like what's television, what's all these traditional broadcasters are now like absorbing all this content to be streaming. And so like what's streaming, I legitimately have no predictions for what 5 years from now looks like in terms of what tradition, like what media is and what.
Right. Yeah, no, it's, we're in a kind of renaissance of television and media and entertainment in this way, you know, because with the emergence of the streamers and also like now we have, you can reach a global audience, which is something that you never could do before. You know, if you were making a television show on ABC or NBC, you were basically trying to reach an American audience. That was what you were making it for. But now if you make a show on Netflix, people in India are watching that show, you know, or on HBO or whatever, you know, like it's like, so there's a whole different, I think in some ways it is amazing. And also people are watching content differently now. They watch it when they want to watch it. They sit, you know, they stream it, they either binge it or they watch it week to, you know, like it's all based on how you want to experience and engage with the content now. And so, you know, this move that my show Evil did, where we went from CBS to Paramount Plus, in some ways I think is a, you know, obviously some people are like, oh, you know, now we don't have Paramount Plus and we had CBS, but I think ultimately it's creatively amazing for us because we get to do stuff on Paramount Plus without like standards and practices.
Right.
And you get to tell stories in a whole different way. And also like reach a much wider audience ultimately. And I think it's just so creatively, it's a great thing. And also like network TV, I think is also recognizing that people aren't sitting down and tuning in at like Thursdays at 10, you know, and there's no sort of must see TV, you know, like when we were growing up, it was like, you know, NBC from 8 to 10, 8 to 11, it was must see TV, you know, like
and Seinfeld and
yeah, like, yeah. You don't have that anymore. And so it's, and, you know, like my kid or like my niece or whatever, they're watching content in a whole different way and on devices and stuff, you know? So I think that this is the future. And you know, and I think ultimately the networks are realizing that, oh, this is where we need to put our energy and our money and our dollars, our advertising dollars into like, so I think you're going to see like, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in terms of like what's going to happen in the next 5 years. We might see huge, like already we saw like Time Warner and HBO or something like merge, yeah. Discovery or something. And Time.
I think it was Discovery and AOL Time Warner.
Yeah. Merge, which is a weird marriage, I think you're going to start seeing these sort of mergers happening where people are going to go, oh, we have a bunch of content. We have a platform that a lot of people but we don't have the content. So you're seeing it already with Paramount Plus. So you got Viacom. And then you've got like all the movies of Paramount coming in. And so they're trying to create a place where you go and you just have like all kinds of content. You can watch movies, you can watch old TV shows, but Frasier, you can watch, you know, whatever, like, you know,
but
Indiana Jones or whatever, you know?
The things that are good about it, I think, are also challenging about it, which is, yes, it's good as a subscriber. You go, oh, okay, so if I pay, I don't know, 10 or 20 bucks a month or whatever it is, $8, $10.
It's like $6 a month.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's great. That's even better. Oh, wow. I, you know, my brain goes, what a value for all these things I get. And then in practical application, I think what can be stressful is like, but how do I sort through all of it? You know,
right. That's true.
We still have to sort it somehow.
Yeah.
And I feel like what we used to do where we'd go to a Blockbuster and spend an hour looking at VHS jackets and going, just doing this algorithm in your head of like cast, you know, like quality of artwork on box, production company. Yeah. All right, I guess this is worth a rental. Now my wife and I will just for an hour just watch trailers for things and then go, I don't know, I'm tired. Let's just, you know, go to bed or put on a...
Right. There's a whole app that's just trailers. Like I will just watch trailers.
Yeah.
And then just be like exhausted from that because it's like I've watched a whole show. You know, like just a bunch of trailers of movies and stuff that I'm not going to watch. But yeah, it is hard to sort through the content. And this is why you're seeing in a weird way that thing that used to happen, that sort of water cooler thing, you know, where did you watch Seinfeld last night or did you watch whatever it was, you know, now is happening in terms of the streaming world. Like, I feel like there's still things of like, oh, you got to see this show. Like I just saw this thing and, you know, and people are now having those conversations. Like we just had some friends over the other day and, you know, it was like part of the conversation was like, have you seen this show? Oh, you got to see this thing. It's great. You know what I mean? Like we just binged it, you know? And so that is now the conversation. The word of mouth, you know, becomes very relevant in all of this.
I got a prediction, Asif, which is that when we start to get older, that our senior citizen center is going to have a series of actual water coolers where people can just cluster and talk about our programs the way we did when
exactly. Yeah.
We'll just talk. It doesn't matter. It could be current shows, you know, could be what happened on LA Law. Like, I don't know. It could,
right.
But just that
LA Law. Wow.
It's a weird pull. I don't know where that. I don't know why. I was just my brain just sort of like cross-referenced old shows from the 80s that we've been talked about at the water cooler, and LA Law is what popped up.
Yeah, I know.
I felt like it could be a drama, had to have a lot of cast members, had to be something where like that people, my brain did a very quick.
It's good. I like LA. LA Law is a good place to go.
Have you, you probably haven't even thought about the show LA Law since LA Law. I don't think anyone, like, when was the last time anyone had like a real.
The crazy thing is that the minute, but the, here's the thing, this is the power of it, right? The minute you said LA Law, I know everyone who, I know Mark Hamill, not Mark Hamill, who is it?
Harry Hamlin.
Harry Hamlin.
Yep, Susan Day.
Susan Day, and then the, now I'm totally blank. I just had all of the images of all the actors. Like I don't remember their names, but I know all the faces of the of Jimmy Smits.
Jimmy Smits was on LA Law.
Yeah, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I remember. You know, it was very much part. That was back when you know you watched. There were only 10 channels. Now there's 189.
You probably remember a Corbin Burnson who was
Corbin Burnson. Oh man,
I'm telling you, man. Like I can't remember what I had for dinner like 3 days ago, but I'm just rattling off LA Law cast members. That's where all that RAM in my brain is going. It's just thinking about the opening credits with the, like a trunk closing and then the license plate that says LA Law. Like that's in my fucking head. That's entirely useful.
Those made indelible marks on us, you know, those shows.
Well, because that's what we didn't, I mean, What else did we really have to do at home in the 80s and the 70s but watch television? It's like, you know, like home gaming systems were fine, but we had it maybe an Atari 2600 or if it was late enough in the 80s, maybe a Nintendo. But in general, our activity at home was like we did not really have home computers that did that much. So it was television for us.
And back then, also the audience for these shows was huge.
Enormous.
Like 10, 12 million people would be watching the show. You know, like I spent a lot of my career trying to get on a network show. And then I finally got on one. And now nobody gives a shit about network television anymore. Yeah.
God damn it.
And, you know, now it's like if you get 3 or 4 million people, like
you're picked up forever.
Yeah, you're doing great, you know. And it used to be that like you needed like 12 million to watch. But, you know, that was the kind of numbers that network TV used to get. You know, Friends, I think, what was the finale of Friends got like 30 million people watching it? Some ridiculous number, right?
I think the last episode of MASH might have been like 80. Like it was like 40 or 80. It was some insane. I gotta look it up because it was some number. Let's see, MASH final, MASH finale ratings. Jesus Christ, 105.9 million viewers. That's insane.
That's insane.
That is like slightly less than a third of our population of the United States population now.
Yeah, yeah. So you realize like that was how many people tuned in at a particular time of night to watch a show.
Dude, okay. So this
same time.
This is where the internet rabbit hole happens. So now I go, okay, what was the population of the United States in 1983? 233.8 million. 50% of
50% of the country watched MASH.
Households with TVs. 50% of people in the United States watched one television program when it aired. That's fucking bananas.
Yeah. And I remember that. I remember because I had only been in the country for about a year at that point. And I remember in high school, everyone was talking about, and I grew up in England, so we didn't watch MASH. And everyone in school was talking about the finale of MASH is on tonight, the finale of MASH. And there was like, and I was just like, and my friends was like, oh my God, it's the greatest show. You got to watch. Like, and there was all this thing of like, you know, like if you don't watch the finale, like people who watch MASH are worthy citizens. People who don't watch MASH are drug addicts and criminals. And you know what I mean? It was, and I remember like I had never even watched the series because I grew up in a different country, but I watched the finale of MASH because it was such a important moment to seemingly to everyone in the country that I came home and we watched it.
I can't even
not knowing what was going on at all. But
I can't even imagine half. I mean, now that would be like 175 million people.
Yeah.
Watching one thing at one specific time. I really can't even wrap my mind around it now. It just isn't. I mean, it's just not something that would be possible anymore. It just isn't. There's just
not. Yeah.
There's no paradigm for it anymore. It just doesn't make sense. It wouldn't even. There would have to be like a technological apocalypse, and then slowly, there's only one way for people to see. Like, so it's just not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. We can't. You can't put the whatever the genie back in the bottle or whatever whatever.
But I'll tell you why I think that's good, especially for performers.
Yeah. Because,
one perspective might be, oh my God, can you imagine if you were on a show that 105 million people watch? But I think also where it was potentially damaging if you were on a show like that, the good and bad side was that because so many people saw you as one character on a show,
yeah,
was very, very difficult for people to then go on and do other things because people just saw them as like, oh, that's Klinger. So I can only see that act. I can only see, I'm not saying that happened to him, but I'm just saying, I'm guessing, and now because the audiences tend to be a little more niche, that I feel like that allows us to be more nimble as performers because, like Evil will have its own audience, and This Way Up, the show that you're doing with Aisling Bea, will have its own audience, and there might be crossover, but there doesn't necessarily have to be, and that's okay. And then people can discover one thing you're on, and then that's sort of a gateway into other stuff.
Right, and I think Hollywood is also catching up to that idea. It used to be that, if you were on a show, you're identified with that show, and that's how they wanted it to be. They didn't want you then doing another show. And now it feels like with the emergence of all this content, it's almost like the good thing for actors is we can do multiple things now. It's becoming more acceptable to do multiple things, which you couldn't do before contractually, right. And I think people are also seeing that it's good for our show if Asif goes and does this other thing, hosts a game show or whatever,
So different than it used. They used to be so territorial.
Oh yeah. 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 It used to be just even up until about 5 or 6 years ago, there used to be a sense of if you're on this network, if you're on Netflix or whatever, you can't go do something on Showtime or, and now it all just feels sort of like people are much more, there's still a little bit of that, but I think it's slowly starting to, the acceptance of the fact that we don't live in a world anymore where these programmers and these networks and studios are controlling and they don't have the viewership to command that kind of control anymore.
I have a prediction, which I think I apologize for the negativity of this prediction. It's a little cynical, but I have this kind of mild fear that some of that could come back because as these mega companies become super mega companies, if you're working, and I'm not saying this is happening, I'm just saying I wonder if it will happen, that if you work for a show that's under an umbrella of one super mega streaming conglomerate that, 50 things, they might go we're, whatever, AOL, Time Warner, Discovery, you did a Netflix show, so we don't want you because now the competition is for, subscription dollars. So maybe... Yeah. Hope that doesn't happen because I agree.
It may just be that at the end of the day, we just got Netflix, Apple, and Disney, and the three of them just own everything.
But then there's NBCU and Viacom and AOL, Time Warner, and Discovery, and that's a shit ton. Discovery Plus alone is a fuck ton of content already.
Yeah.
And then AOL, Time Warner is a mega fuck ton of content. I mean, it's like, so it just, it is like watching everything. It's just like a lava lamp, just like watching these things break apart and then just you know, like glob back together. But then how do these companies work? How do the infrastructures of these mega companies work, fold together? And how do they deliver, you know, is it like, well, we're going to put them all on one app? Or like, oh no, if you, you know, if you subscribe to Discovery Plus, then you also get,
yeah,
you know, and you get 53 hours of America Online. You know, I have no, I mean, I have no idea how it's going to work, but
it's also an, a merging of the entertainment industry and tech.
Right.
We see a lot, you know, like we see it with Apple, we see it with Netflix. And how does that work? Because you have companies like Apple, which come from tech and are entering into entertainment, and they're right. bringing all of that tech knowledge. And then you've got companies like Paramount Plus or CBS, whatever, which are entering from the entertainment side, or HBO, into a tech world and creating these platforms that are driven by algorithms and technology and stuff. Like, you know?
I know. And I think our content is going to end up becoming more like British television, where they do like two seasons of something.
Yeah.
And then they're done.
And even with Evil, we're not doing 22 episodes. We're doing 13 on CBS. And now when we go to Paramount Plus, we'll be doing 10.
Right.
For the third season. And so, and often that actually helps with the quality of a show, because
no filler.
Because I was talking to Robert King about this actually early on when we decided to do, when they were like, we're going to do 13 instead of 22, which would be a normal network buy. And he was like, look, you know, we did that. And there's always like three or four shows that you just kind of don't like. And you're just like, ah, those are just filler, you know, like, because you got to fill in 22 episodes.
Some episodes have a budget, so they got to do those. They got to do those episodes where maybe you're just in an office for the whole time, because it's
exactly.
We just stay a little bit so we could blow up something in episode 10.
Right. You're stuck in an elevator or in a bunker or something, you know. And it's like,
remember?
But yeah. Or you resort to like a very special episode.
A very special episode. I want to remind, so Evil is on Paramount Plus, and This Way Up is on Hulu.
On Hulu.
The show with Aisling Bea, and that's July 9th. Is there anything else you're working on that you want people to know about, or anything that
Evil is streaming right now. We're streaming, you know, we just started. Like you said, This Way Up, July 9th. I'm really excited about that. We did season 2.
So great.
You know, and I had such a blast working with those people. Sharon Horgan, Aisling, I'm such huge fans of theirs that I, you know, even went to London and did it for no money. So it was just a complete, I just had fun. I've got a couple of animated projects that are coming out at some point. One for Netflix called The Magician's Elephant, which is based on a best-selling French novel. And it's got some great people in it, Mandy Patinkin and then another thing called Blazing Samurai, which is based on the 70s movie Blazing Saddles that Mel Brooks did. And Mel Brooks is producing the animated movie, which is all about a dog that ends up in a Western town full of cats. And so I'm excited about that. That's coming out as well. And those are the two animated features that that will come out probably maybe this year or later this year or next year or sometime.
Fantastic. Are you in New York now?
I'm in New York, and this is where I live and have managed to actually stay here this whole time. During this pandemic, we were bunkered down in our home here in New York. Yeah.
Have you traveled a lot? Are you going to travel some more?
You know, we haven't traveled because we have a baby. And so, although we just did take a road trip with him down, my wife is from Atlanta, so we drove to South Carolina to Hilton Head for a couple of weeks and then drove over to Atlanta and then drove back to New York. And I was like, I'm never doing this again. Like, it was like, we travel. My wife and I used to take road trips all the time before we had a child. And now it's like, we're like the Rolling Stones. Like, we just got so much shit. Like, I'm literally that guy with the huge SUV on the freeway. Like, you know, the kids in the car seat. I got, you know, just boxes of like toys and books and, you know, baby bathtubs and all of his shit in the back, you know, and we're just driving across country. So But it was great. And we got to take our son to the beach for the first time. And that was really, because also like he was born during a pandemic. So he hasn't seen the world. Like
right.
He's barely seen, you know, he's seen people on screens and stuff, but he's not really gone out into the world. So we were like, let's go down and take him to the beach. And it was really kind of cool to have him.
Good. Any good, because eventually my wife and I, our plan is to have kids, and
yeah.
We also like road trips, and I was kind of thinking like, okay, so because you get out on some stretches of highway and there's not like you know you get to these, obviously now there's a lot of stuff. When I was growing up, my dad loved to drive everywhere, so
yeah.
There was a lot less stuff in between in the 70s and 80s. But now, however, you will get to these stretches. So if your child is like freaking the fuck out, as they are prone to do sometimes, and you can't really stop, you can't. Is it a distraction? Do you like squeak a toy? Do you have to stop? Do you get out? Do you kind of walk them around? Like what are your tips?
So it's funny you ask this, because actually this happened to us in North Carolina. And so when my wife was pregnant and he was in vitro or whatever you call that, in utero.
Right.
I would sing to him every night in her stomach, because, you know, they say that you should do that. And then the child and so the thing is, I sang the Beatles, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," to my son when he was in my wife's stomach every night. So now, as he's now 15 months old, he's like almost a year and a half. In order to get him to go to sleep, we have to sing, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," "All My Loving," and "Yesterday."
Yesterday.
So
such a fun song.
I do my McCartney Beatles medley.
That is so spectacular. That's a good like baby brain hack, by the way.
I know. So we were like literally like, we'll be in the car. And he will not be going to sleep, and he's crying, and it's his nap time, and my wife will literally be like, "Sing, start singing." I'm driving, and I'm literally, it's the most, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, tell you something, boom, 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 I don't understand," and I'm just like singing at the top of my lungs, and you know what? It fucking works. Like, he calms down. And his whatever, like, you know, thing he's got going on, he calms down, he settles down, and he sometimes often fall asleep. I have to just do it on a loop. I have to just sing old Beatles songs on a loop, and then he will just slowly calm down. I hope to meet Paul McCartney one day and tell him that.
That is spectacular, because you know that in 20 years or 25 years, you're going to get a phone call. "Yeah, I got really bad insomnia. Can you just do the thing?" "It's like 2 o'clock in the morning." "I know, but please close your eyes." And "Yesterday."
Yeah, exactly.
Can we just wean you on to the recording? Because the Beatles have a pretty good version of that song. Are you sure? It's got to be. All right.
It's funny. It's like, and because of I sang it to him when he was inside her, like, only I can sing it. Like, if my wife sings it, it doesn't work. And I feel like he's going to actually one day discover that I didn't write these songs.
You know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to go into a studio and record them, because if you go work on a job and you're traveling.
Yeah, I'm not going to be around. Yeah.
You're not going to be around. And
she's going to be able to play it on her iPad or on her iPhone and have me. Yeah. I mean, that may be true.
Well, it is so wonderful to see you.
So great, man.
Really hope I get to see you in person at some point. Maybe I'll run into you at another Creative Arts Emmy situation or something, you know.
You can only hope. Yeah.
Now that we can be around people again. So I hope you take care, and I hope I see you. I hope I see you sooner. I really feel like it's been like 7 or 8 years.
Yes, I think the last time I did it, I did your podcast, was you had a place, I forget, off of Santa
Monica. It was a Meltdown Comics.
Yes, yeah.
It's not there anymore, by the way. Not only the comic shop, the entire block is gone.
Is it really?
It's like the person who owned that whole block sold it, or they're developing it or something, but it is
across the street from that guitar place.
That's right, yeah. And yeah. It's gone. Like, literally, that a whole city block is probably going to just be like glass box condos and like and Chipotle's or something underneath. So,
wow.
I don't know. But that was fun, man. It's really, really good to see you.
Anyway, great to see you. And I hope to see you in person someday.
The end.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.